Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Conversations with John Anderson, featuring James Orr.
Dr. James Orr is Associate Professor of Philosophy of Religion at the Faculty of Divinity, Cambridge University in the United Kingdom. He's the author of several books and many academic articles. His expertise is in the philosophy of religion, and he is a regular commentator on issues facing Britain and the West more generally today. He's also the UK chairman of the Edmund Burke Foundation. James, it's terrific of you to join me. We've known one another for a while, partly because we were on the organising committee for the ARC conference in London. But many of my listeners will actually know you because they will have heard you or seen you interacting with the extraordinary Jordan Peterson and a group of others, including Oz Guinness and Dennis Prager, talking through the importance in this day and age of the Torah, the early books of the Old Testament, in setting up what might be called the ideas of covenantal governance, cooperation, subsidiarity, a societal structure that works and gives people human opportunity for human flourishing and advancement. So that must have been a very interesting time, a group of you gathered together. As I say, many of our listeners will have heard those or seen them or both.
It was a great privilege to be involved, John, just as it's a great privilege to be with you today. And these sort of long form content is just a wonderful way to take a deep text, take a difficult problem, and to chew it over at great length. And in the case of the Exodus discussions, I think we went for not far off 40 hours, which were edited down, of course. I mean, I remember on the second day, we were still on chapter 3. There are 40 chapters in Exodus. And I said to Jordan, look, God put the Israelites into the desert for 40 years. You're going to have us in this studio for 40 days. And the Daily Wire team very graciously agreed to a second series. But we kept going and going and going because, as you say, the early books of the Old Testament, Hebrew Scriptures, are limitless. They are depthless, and both in themselves, just they are conceptually fascinating. They are fascinating to the secular mind, as we discovered, because many of the viewpoints around that table took a sort of secular perspective, but also in their applicability to the modern age. As you say, this questions of covenant over contract, this is an increasingly big question in
So contract's a narrow thing.
Yeah.
It's narrowly defined and it's designed to make certain that you can get out of it, to put it in the negative, pretty easily if you want to, whereas a covenantal arrangement entered into between peoples, individuals, or vast numbers of people, and so forth. It's all about cooperation. It's all about seeking the best for everyone.
Yes.
It's all about an attitude of mind that says, we'll all pitch in.
I think that's right. I think there's something intrinsic to the notion of covenant that involves promise and involves a dimension of unilaterality. That is to say, contract. You know, God can't enter into contracts, but he can make covenants. He can make promises. He can certainly constrain himself. He can impose obligations on himself. But there aren't any sort of contractual provisions you can enter with God and for God to remain God. So there's a notion of promise. There's a notion of permanence, I think, to covenant, where there aren't sort of escape clauses in covenants. And there's a sense of self-giving, of a kind of, I suppose, a form of grace, a sort of gift. You covenant and you make a commitment, you bind yourself. and that elicits the binding of another, the free entering freely into a covenantal agreement. And I think, of course, the question that looms once you've moved from questions of social contract and the contractarianism that develops after Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau in the 17th and 18th century, you shift towards, if we start thinking about covenantalism, you do start thinking about the vertical covenant, which is, of course, where Exodus begins and Genesis begins in many ways, that the horizontal covenant emerges out of, is underpinned by, underwritten by, a vertical covenant. Now, that's a much more difficult question to address in an age that is as secular as ours, where religion has been, as it were, privatized. It is something that's been domesticated. Religion is something to be conducted only between consenting adults behind closed doors.
If you must.
If you absolutely must, then we'd rather you wouldn't. We'd rather you didn't.
Yeah.
This is the great Rawlsian system. John Rawls's Theory of Justice, 1971. He says, you know, in order to achieve a maximally just society, we must bracket our, quote, comprehensive metaphysical commitments. And by that, of course, he includes contentious religious commitments, but in fact, far broader metaphysical commitments too. Metaphysical commitments that aren't obviously religious, but that are plainly philosophical, about freedom, about human nature, who we are as human beings, about our consciousness, about rationality, and so on. Those are plainly comprehensive metaphysical commitments that reasonable people can disagree about, and yet we're supposed to bracket those and then work out how to be a just society. Questions of justice itself, questions of equality, these are contentious questions that we're debating all the time in the seminar rooms in Rawls's Harvard or Parfit's Oxford.
Well, these are very difficult times, and it's important to have these debates. It really is, as we try to find a better way forward at a time of enormous self-doubt, even self-loathing. But we'll come back to that, because what I'd like to begin with is why you, as a very, very capable person, a professional lawyer, switched really into philosophy, and in a very senior role now, you carry that forward at Cambridge University, presuming it wasn't a pursuit of great wealth. I can't imagine that would have worked out too well.
What drove you
down that road?
Not financial wealth. There's time wealth. That there are other forms of wealth.
Touché. Touché.
And I'm not sure about capable, but I was privileged enough to have a wonderful education in the English system. The English schools are the best in the world, the English private schools, and I did lots of Latin and Greek, which I found terrifying and deadly boring to begin with, but it began to open up for me in my teenage years, and I started to read a little bit of Plato, and that carried on at university. So I was interested in philosophy, but I didn't think I was any good at it. In fact, I certainly wasn't any good at it. I was always intimidated by people who did philosophy. I did the bare minimum at university. I did classics, so you had to do some ancient philosophy. The catalytic moment was, in fact, when I was working as a lawyer in London, in the city. The really catalytic moment was a conversion to Christianity. It wasn't a very bookish conversion. It was actually it was a sort of series of Damascene moments. At the end of which I came to the view that God was real and that the Christian revelation was the truest and most authentic revelation of God. So that immediately set me on the path to looking for the sort of philosophical scaffolding for these experiences. And that's what got me into contemporary philosophy. That's where I started reading philosophy at the weekends, and it was soon every other weekend, then it was soon every weekend. And I would nip across from my offices in Freshfields on Fleet Street to the King's College London Library in the evenings and at the weekends. And after a few months of this, my wife turned to me and said, your brother's negotiating for Saturday afternoons at Stamford Bridge to watch Chelsea. You're negotiating to go to a university library and sit with some dusty books and read them. You know, this is not normal behaviour. Have you considered that you may have a vocation, or you may have this is something that you may want to take further? Most wives would have been horrified at the thought that I'd walk away from a fancy lawyer job and into becoming a student again. But that's exactly what I did at the age of 30 with a young family in tow, went up to Cambridge and entered a pretty uncertain time as a graduate student, but a glorious time. I was very fortunate to be accepted in the Faculty of Divinity at Cambridge as a graduate student, where I now teach full-time. And I had a brief period in Oxford after my graduate studies with the great Nigel Bigger at Christchurch, and that's when we really started to get forced into the culture wars, and the empire wars in particular. We could talk about that in a bit, perhaps. And then I ended up back in Cambridge. But the key moment for me towards philosophy was faith. That was what instilled in me the sort of intellectual restlessness about, you know, about the fundamental questions.
So were the likes of Bertrand Russell wrong when he implied that Christian faith was somehow incompatible with philosophy? Can you be both?
Yeah. Wittgenstein has a wonderful remark somewhere where he says that all of Russell's books, of course he knew Russell very well, all of Russell's books should be divided into two. And you should have the black books and the red books. And I can't remember which way around it is, but the black books everyone must read, and the red books are complete nonsense, and don't touch them. And I think a lot of Russell's writings on religion were in Wittgenstein's view as well, on the sort of latter half, the kind of post 1918, 1919 phase of Russell's life. It's hard to know where to start explaining what's wrong with the thought that philosophy and religion or faith are intrinsically incompatible. I think the belief that they are is itself a symptom of this tendency, of the tendency of all of us in the modern age to think that all ideas began roughly 100 years ago and everything before that was darkness and confusion. And there is a tendency in contemporary analytic Anglophone philosophy to think that Bertrand Russell and G.E. Moore started philosophy at the high table of Trinity College, Cambridge, in somewhere around, you know, October 1903. And everything up to that was just, you know, to be an embarrassment to be forgotten. But of course, philosophy goes right back to the dawn of time, the dawn of thought, the dawn of the beginnings of the human record. Even before Socrates, you have thinkers like Anaxagoras and Thales and Xenophanes and so on who are doing philosophy. It's a sort of philosophy, it's a sort of natural science, and their answers are freighted with appeals to divinity. Socrates is put on trial, not for being an atheist, but for introducing new gods. Not even Epicurus. Actually, it's very, very difficult to find in the ancient world, or late antiquity, or the medieval period, a philosopher who you could say is an atheist, that is to say, repudiates all content to religious beliefs. And you know, even the Epicureans were committed to the existence of the gods. They just didn't think they were around anymore. they got bored and gone off and gone somewhere else. But actually finding an atheist pre 1600 is not very easy. Even if you think of Anselm, when he's talking about, when he's trying to put the atheist perspective, has to quote scripture, has to quote the fictive character in the Psalms, the fool who says in his heart that there is no God. He doesn't say, oh, those atheists who claim that there is no God. I mean, it's an almost inconceivable thought that there are such things. So atheism is a very new kid on the block, as it were. It's in the grand sweep of Western history and in the grand sweep of the world, so both diachronically and synchronically, as it were, atheism, though it's got a sort of disproportionately vocal representation these days and over the last 100 years, is actually quite a curious and I'd say quite sort of superstitious position, one that requires the suspension of partial suspension of reason and a kind of skepticism and agnosticism about all kinds of dimensions of human experience and reality. I sometimes call them the M words. I think I borrow that from somebody else. But you think of morality. You think of music. Think of mathematics. Think of meaning. Metaphysics itself. These are all plainly fascinating domains about which intelligible questions can be raised and answers given that elude the dominant philosophical orthodoxies of our age, which, roughly speaking, is the view that all truths are scientific truths. or reducible to scientific truths. This is the view sometimes called scientism or naturalism or sometimes physicalism, materialism. You know, it is the house philosophy of secular liberalism. But it can't cope with the M-words. It can't cope with mind. It can't cope with morality. It can't cope with music as something irreducible. It can't even cope with mathematics. These are all domains that you can't be put under a microscope. You can't do scientific tests on. That the empiricist is going to miss. And so, in a way, you know, atheism and reductive physicalism brings with it not just an impoverished view of religion, but an impoverished view of human nature and an impoverished view of reality itself.
Would you say that your Christianity has been more informed by your interest in philosophy, or would you say the other way around?
It's a very difficult question because many Christian claims, many of the kind of most fundamental architectonic Christian claims are plainly philosophical claims. God exists. That is a philosophical claim. It is open to argument, arguments in its favour, and it's open to arguments against it. Philosophical arguments, not just bland appeals to revelation or whatever. Christ is two natures in one person without confusion, change, division, or separation, as the Council of Chalcedon tells us. Now, that's a doctrinal, creedal claim, but it's got to work philosophically. So how does it work philosophically? Well, we have to start thinking about, well, what is a nature? And what is a person? And these are intrinsically philosophical problems that are with us still. Think of the old debate about, you know, can I be free to choose what I have for breakfast tomorrow morning if God already knows what I'm going to have for breakfast tomorrow morning? You know, there's a sort of, you know, if I'm really free, then God's knowledge is false about what I'm going to have for breakfast. If God's knowledge is fixed, then I have got no choice about what I have for breakfast. It's going to be the cornflakes. Now, there's just, you know, that's the same argument as we work with today in the secular context between determinism. Is it Darwin all the way down, or are we genuinely free on top of that? In my own case, I think, to go back to your question, I actually started with, my faith began, as it were, my conversion experiences were experiences. That is to say, they didn't rely on books or ideas, but answered skeptical prayers. But I immediately went not into philosophy, but into the historicity of the New Testament. That was my first, that was my right. Starting point. I had been fortunate enough, as I said earlier, to pick up Greek. And if you've got some classical Greek, then Koine Greek, the New Testament Greek, is just gloriously readable. All of the New Testament, except for Hebrews and Revelation, I could pretty much read a sight read. And this was a revelation because the 27 sort of New Testament texts were both continuous with the texts I've read from the same period in the first century, and also very different. They were continuous in the sense that they were texts. They were documents from the first century. And suddenly I was, you know, everything I'd done in classics, and reading Tacitus, reading Suetonius, reading Caesar, all the tools that I applied were there. Well, I said, well, why shouldn't I use the same tools on these documents? No reason for sort of double standards and so on. So there was a continuity there, but there was a sharp discontinuity, mainly I noticed in the manuscript tradition. You know, when we're reading Tacitus, for example, Tacitus is wonderful annals. I mean, there's only sort of four of the. It's pockmarked. I mean, it's there's hardly any. There's a lot big chunks missing. And we have to sort of guess what happened in the for a lot of the emperors because the manuscript tradition is so poor, or even Homer, you know, the Iliad gets to us only via a tiny number of manuscripts from late antiquity. In the case of the New Testament, I realized you had 5,000 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, 10,000 Latin, a whole load of other languages too. So that was there was a sort of sharp discontinuity, a very busy so-called apparatus criticus at the bottom, which shows you all the different readings which textual critics look at to try and get the exact text. That was a revelation. So it started with historicity claims and thinking hard about the historical case for the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus and the early Christian movement. And then I had lunch one day with a friend in the city, and I sort of told him what I was reading, and I, you know, laid out some of these sort of historicity arguments, and particularly for the resurrection. And he said, yeah, it's fine. I don't believe that. But, I mean, it's... I said, well, look, it's, there's more evidence for it than, say, that, you know, Caesar crossing the Rubicon, or for the Battle of Actium. Why wouldn't you, you know, take these seriously? At least the sort of... He said, well, dead people stay dead. I said, so if I showed you a video, it was 20 years ago, VHS or a DVD, of Easter morning, the star, you know, the rock being rolled back, and you know, actually, you actually saw it. You said, well, I would disbelieve the DVD. I said, if I put you in a time machine and we went back to the cave and we were there somehow, would you believe it? He said, no. Dead people take it. Now, I since discovered this is Hume's argument, you know, that the evidence of one's senses should be doubted if the uniform custom of human experience denies it. A little bit more complicated than that. What that lunch taught me, I left that lunch realizing that the historical approach to faith could only really be a hobby. What really mattered was the deeper philosophical claims. That is to say, if you were not willing to accept, it started with your priors, and if your priors were all truths are scientific truths, the naturalistic priors, then of course dead people stay dead. Those are the scientific truths. And no historical evidence, certainly not evidence from 2,000 years ago, however strong it is relative to other historical documents from 2,000 years ago, is going to be dispositive. So I realized that the real work would need to be done at the philosophical level. How do you raise those priors? So you're not going to find any kind of Christian evidence is compelling, or Islamic evidence is compelling, or Sikh evidence is compelling, if you haven't got a prior commitment to theism being possible, naturalism being false. And that will raise the probability and make it easier, well, certainly, make it more reasonable, or at least not, will put you in a position where you're not ruling out a priori the possibility of the claims being, of other non-naturalistic claims being made in documents like the New Testament being true.
It's certainly surely the case that just as no one can stand and say science can disprove God, it's also the case that you can't find anything in the historical records that can be, if you like, proven to be wrong.
Yes, that's right. I mean, that's because science studies the repeatable. Scientific truths are true in virtue of their having been repeated empirically and through the hypothetical deductive model. And history relies on the unrepeatable, the once and only once. Of course, we look for patterns in history. We look for ways they might rhyme. But we are we're dealing with a different category of human inquiry. And to go back to your question, I mean, not only, my view is that not only is there, I don't think there's such a thing as a scientific proof. In fact, I don't think science can prove itself. When you're using the language of proof, you're really only using the language of mathematics. The only proofs you get are in mathematics. Give you an example, if we were to find out that children were reading physics textbooks from the 1920s, we'd be worried. Why? Because physics textbooks of the 1920s don't contain proofs. They contain the best scientific theorizing of the 1920s. But theorizing, that thinking develops. It develops and develops. Mathematical textbooks, well, we'd be delighted if children were working with mathematical textbooks from the 1920s. Why? Because mathematics relies, there are theorems in mathematics. There are only theories in science. And science is falsifying itself all the time. And science can't prove itself because science itself relies on prior truths being true. Notoriously, science relies on mathematical truths being true. And mathematical truths are not scientific truths. Scientific truths presuppose mathematical truths. And the more science we do, the more physics we do, the more mathematical it gets. Mathematics is even more than history. History at least happens once. Mathematics doesn't happen at all, and yet it's always and everywhere true, that 2 + 2 = 4. You can't date it. Those truths are necessarily true. They don't begin to be true. They don't cease to be true. They are rock solid truths. You can develop proofs from them, and they're more rock solid than any scientific conjecture or any scientific theory that's ever been formulated.
You've spoken of what you call a historical shift, as people have stopped even asking the big questions that we've been talking about and decided against belief, broadly speaking, in the West. You have seen a lot of shifts, and one that you've nailed in a very interesting way, and I'm quoting, it's been from sin to syndrome.
Mm. Yes.
Sin being the idea of wrongdoing, which is one of the great objections people have, of course, to the Bible. I don't know how you explain evil if you don't think there's sin. Mm. People don't think it through clearly, but understandably, I suppose, there's a reaction against the idea that I might be myself to blame for a lot of the world's ills. Mm. Now we've had this shift from a Christian society, you're saying, to a therapeutic society. Mm. What would you say is a therapeutic society? How's it manifesting itself? Mm. Why is it problematic to use a term that's bandied around a lot?
Yes, I mean, I think that's right. I'm not even sure that phrase is mine, sin to syndrome. I might have picked it up somewhere, but it captures that shift very, very nicely from a sense of moral culpability, which presupposes moral agency. And I think culpability and blame and sin, they're not nice words these days, but in fact they're words that do belong to a sort of conceptual web of nice things, of things that have always been recognized to be important. To recognize somebody as having committed wrongdoing rather than simply being the victim of some pathology is to treat that person as free and rational. And Kant, I don't agree with Kant about much, but Kant is right that at least part of what human dignity consists in is freedom and reason. So to treat somebody as a sinner is to treat them as somebody who is free and who is mature and rational. To treat them as a patient in the grip of a syndrome, I think, is not to treat them with their full humanity and dignity. Worse, it is, to coin another fashionable word, disempowering to say that somebody is in the grip of a pathology, a syndrome, rather than a sin. Why? Well, if you've committed a sin, you can seek forgiveness, certainly within the Christian traditions and other religious traditions. There are mechanisms, salvific mechanisms, the mechanisms for absolution and repentance and social recognition of second chances as well as condemnation. If you've got a disease, if your wrongdoing is a symptom of something that is wrong with you or wrong with your mind, you're stuck with it, really, or at least it's much less obvious how you get rid of it. Do you medicate your way out of it? Well, yes, sometimes. Do you find a therapeutic way out of it? Well, yes, sadly, sometimes. But most of the time, these are problems that are fixed. I have this condition, and there's no way I can sort of get out of it. And so, you know, crimes start to be treated as diseases, and criminals or wrongdoers start to be treated as patients. And the state then turns into not that which gives expression to social condemnation through punishment and retribution, but rather the state becomes a kind of omnicompetent therapist. And that's a very dangerous development in my view, because we know that our moral instincts, shared moral instincts, help us to track moral truth, broadly speaking. There's a moral consensus in every society. Classifying pathologies, classifying diseases, mental, particularly psychological diseases, are as it were, that is a very tricky business. You need to get in the experts. Who's in control of the experts? The state is in control of the experts. And so you actually move from a position of sort of moral consensus, and I think democracy depends upon, you know, the plumber at leaving school at 16 having just as much just as capable and fully functioning moral capacity for moral judgment as a you know, fancy professor with multiple ethics degrees. So we shift there to morality. Moral judgment becomes a sort of question of technique and expertise. And that, I think, is a disturbing development. And you see this with sort of, you know, the language of health and safety. You see it as sort of invoking and justifying very clear erosions of civil liberties. And I think one of the big, you know, we've talked, and I know you've talked with your guests on previous podcasts, John, about this, you know, left and right not quite being the correct prism to understand the public square with through anymore. And I think that's absolutely right. And the question, I think, is what are the other spectrums and axes? And I think at least one of them is risk and safety, or freedom and safety. That's a trade-off. Yet clearly we can't just allow total freedom in a way that undermines in serious ways public safety. On the other hand, it's obvious that we can't just live in lockdown the whole time, that there are more important things in life than the avoidance of death. We're going to have to walk across the street even though there is a minimal risk that we might get run over and so on. So how do we find that trade-off? And I think that's going to be that axis, as it were, of public disagreement is emerging more and more in recent years, partly driven by plagues, but also driven, I think, by the transposition from the move from sin to syndrome, and the language of the psychologizing of medicine. My own view is that mental health is an unfortunate phrase. I know what people mean by it, but I think it's a metaphor that's got out of control. I don't think there's any such thing as physical health. All health is physical health, in my view. Mental health, what is mental health? The phrase mental health implies that there is a medical science, as it were, that is focused on the mind as an object of scientific inquiry, like a bone or a cancer, or a cancerous cell. If that's true, then the champions of mental health as a phrase, as a literal phrase, a non-metaphorical phrase, have solved one of the biggest problems in the history of philosophy, namely the mind-body problem. And the mind-body problem just is the problem of, is the mind an object, a scientific object? Is the mind the brain? Now, my view, and it's maybe not a popular view in contemporary philosophy, but certainly I'd say the overwhelming consensus of philosophers in the West has been that, yeah, that when we're talking about soul or mind or consciousness, we are talking about something that's real and not fully reducible to underlying neurophysiological states. Now, maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong. It's an open question. The phrase mental health closes that question. It says we've settled that question. We've settled the question of whether or not the mind is something that can be both explored by scientific means and solved and addressed, as it were, cured by scientific means. And I think there's a deep conceptual confusion, a category mistake embedded in that phrase, which leads to all kinds of dialogues of the deaf and policy confusion, because we start to then think of psychological suffering in terms that are the same as physical suffering. So we'll look at sort of, you know, cancer rates and waiting lists, and then we'll look at the rates and waiting lists for generalized anxiety disorder. GAD is one of these phrases a student explained to me the other day, which I think is just being a little bit anxious, you know. So this is a deep problem, and it's one that I think disconnects us. Maybe this is accelerated by the digital revolution, but it disconnects us from and renders problematic, as it were, ordinary features of human experience. I asked a young person the other day to explain to me what was the phrase? I think it was social phobia. So what is social phobia? Well, it turned out that it was just anxiety. I've got GAD, one person said, generalized anxiety disorder. I said, well, why do you think you've got GAD? He said, well, I don't know. I'm just feeling very stressed. And I pointed out that the student had very important exams in a few months' time. I said, do you think that's why you've got GAD? And she said, yes, probably, that's definitely, I'm worrying a lot about my exams. I said, well, not only is that normal, it's actually good. You know, it's good to feel anxious about your exams, because you're going to do better, and it's a totally normal, non-pathological response to an ordinary human scenario. There was a study done a few years ago, a fascinating article by a group of psychologists trying to explore at what point grief becomes PTSD. And it's fascinating trying to be watching these experts trying to fix the appropriate limits on grief. So, you know, they were trying to settle the question of, you know, how long is it reasonable for you to feel grief over the death of a loved one? You know, at which point does it just cease to be acceptable? At what point does grief turn into a pathology? Well, my view is there is no answer. You shouldn't even be looking for an answer to that question.
It's going to be different for everyone.
It's going to be different for everyone, and you're not going to be able to quantify it, and it's none of your business. You know, leave me alone with all your fancy acronyms. And once I've got PTSD, then I'll. Mm. If you start calling it PTSD, then I guarantee that I'll have that longer than my grief may have lasted had I not pathologized it.
Just following this through a little bit from a sort of more layman's perspective, I suppose, it seems to me that with the loss of the idea of sin, and as you've said, that's tied to agency. Mm. If you're fully human. Mm.
And dignity.
And fully engaged, you need to have a mechanism for dealing with the fact that there is evil. You need then to move to the point where we're all capable of it and life isn't a battle between good and bad people because we're all a mixture. Mm. That was a traditional understanding. And that led to concepts like, fessing up, facing reality. Mm. You've got it wrong. Mm. You need to apologise. Mm. And the notion of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that a therapeutic society, actually, because it can't deal with guilt and fessing up and forgiveness, turns out to be anything but therapeutic. It's actually quite cruel. Mm. And for young people today, the idea of cancel culture, the great terror is you can't be forgiven if you've done something that is wrong, even if it's not wrong, frankly, in the eyes of the people around you and they cancel you, you're not going to be forgiven. There's no redemption and it's not even going to be forgotten. Mm-hmm. So a therapy culture turns out, I'm just testing this by you to see whether I sort of got a bit of a handle on what you're saying, turns out actually to be a very cruel one. It denies agency, it denies forgiveness, it denies a sort of attitude of deep commitment to accepting others in the end.
I think that's absolutely right. And you know, if everything is therapeutic, then as it were, nothing is therapeutic. That is to say, if everything is can be explained in just sort of psychological terms, then we do sort of start to lose our grip on being able to work out well what genuine instances of psychological suffering might be. And I think there is a cruelty to it, yes, because there is an idea, there is this sense that once you've got, as it were, a psychological condition, you can't really escape from it. There is no cure, there's no medicine, there's medication, and that opens up, you know, the pharmaceutical solutions. And I take very seriously left-wing critiques of Big Pharma being deeply complicit in the triumph of the therapeutic. And because it renders individuals dependent, increasing numbers of individuals dependent on Big Pharma, and certainly the rates. There was a report quite recently in the UK showing staggering levels of consumption of antidepressants, particularly up in Scotland. And
and amongst our children.
Yes, absolutely right. Absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And so this way of, and that comes from the assumption that if somebody's got suffering from poor mental health, then there must be some solution to it that's analogous to the solutions that we offer to bad physical health, medicine. Now, it's not the same thing, though. You know, psychological suffering is a qualitatively different kind of thing. It's still suffering. I mean, nobody's suggesting that. I don't for a moment want to say that psychological suffering isn't real. Mm-hmm. I'm simply saying that framing it by analogy, by metaphor, that then gets concretized to with respect to the physical medical sciences, introduces all sorts of problems, one of which is the only real solution to this is something that's analogous to physical cures, pills.
Yeah. So here we have a situation where I think you and I are broadly agreeing here. You're at a level well above me, I have
Nonsense.
To say, James. But let's try and tease out something here. We're saying that in fact it seems that a therapeutic culture is one in which it turns out that many modern attitudes are hurtful and even harmful to people's well-being. But that therapeutic society now, if you like, which is pretty widespread, it's pretty thick through our society, they're saying we're the ones, we Christian believers, when we talk about sin and guilt and conscience in the way that we do, we're the ones that can be hurtful and even harmful. So we've got a real problem. And in my own country, this is manifesting as in a debate over religious freedoms. The term itself is interesting. Do you find freedom through religion, or do you find freedom by, if you like, pushing it back into the private square and, if possible, obliterating it altogether? We've got ourselves in a mess, haven't we?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Absolutely right. And I've been tracking that debate over religious freedom quite a lot in Australia and indeed elsewhere. Part of the difficulty here, I think, is expanding. Again, it's connected to what we were saying earlier about the psychologizing of absolutely everything. With John Stuart Mill, the classical liberal has his no harm principle. My freedom to do what I want ends with my fist at your on your face, as it were. No harm, no physical harm should be inflicted. But within that, I am my autonomous self, capable of. I'm free to exercise myself. I'm free to take whatever decisions I want and to act on them as I see fit. Once the notion of harm is psychologized, as you say, then all bets are off. If you then wed that to the no harm principle, then you've got a recipe for tyranny. Because the problem of psychologizing harm is that it's not at all obvious what evidence against there having been a harm, there being a harm having been committed, it looks like. And there simply isn't any objective. What is the dispositive evidence is the subjective self-reported claim that I am harmed, I feel hurt, I feel offended. There's no jury that can inspect evidence and reach and deliberate over whether or not that claim is true, because psychological harm is by definition something to which only the subject has private privileged access. And it doesn't matter, you go to Harley Street and you go to some of the best psychologists in the world, is not going to be able to have access to those private states. Now that changes the sort of incentive structures in very really fundamental ways. It's a recipe for tyranny because you can just now apply classical liberalism, psychologized and tweaked, and you've got a recipe for tyranny because you've effectively the society starts to move at the same pace as the most offended. Well, it has to stop and put everything down as the most offended person in the class. Has a tantrum or screams, and now we don't know if it's veridical or not. We don't know if it's true or not. But if the person knows that society is going to stop or the institution is going to respond, then there's obviously an incentive structure in place to use and abuse the system. So it's obviously a profound concern. And of course, these things have a habit. Psychological conditions, psychological syndromes have the habit of being, self-fulfilling, and capable of being spread with extraordinary speed through mimesis and mimetic effects, as we know. It's sometimes called the Werther effect, after Goethe's The Sorrow of the Young Werther, or the Marilyn Monroe effect. This is a very good example of where the no harm principle breaks down on the question of suicide. Now, suicide seems to be the paradigmatically private act, the private, purely private exercise of my free will over my own life. No one can tell me not to, and so on. This is the classic sort of liberal case for decriminalizing suicide. But of course, as we know, after The Sorrows of the Young Werther was a huge hit, and Goethe in the late 18th century, and Marilyn Monroe, when Marilyn Monroe died, and so on, these have enormous mimetic effects. They're not purely private decisions, especially if you have a public status. There's a very powerful mimetic effect. I remember when I was a postdoctoral fellow in Oxford, I lived on a staircase and would go in, and every morning I would see some well-meaning poster from the the college nurse with an enormous question mark on it. And underneath it would say, worried, depressed, feeling low, we're here to help. And it was a nice thing to do, but I would walk in very chirpy every morning, and then I'd look at the poster and think, well, gosh, actually, maybe I'm not feeling all right. there is that little problem I'm worried about. Maybe I'm not worrying about it enough, and so on. So there's a sort of self-fulfilling effect, and there's a mimetic effect. And so these things can spread very, very quickly and become real. They become real. So it's a deep, deep difficulty, and it's not at all clear how one emerges from it either, because one doesn't want to belittle or trivialize it, and one doesn't want to, in a way, Wittgenstein says famously, a picture holds us captive. And as it were, the therapeutic as a sort of the conceptual architecture of the therapeutic is so sort of structured modern culture that it holds us captive. It's hard to see how we can break out. There are bunkers, and I think religious communities are bunkers because they can speak, as it were, the old language, the language from and they are communities that tend to have the antibodies, as it were, to use another medical metaphor, the antibodies to the therapeutic culture, and also recognize. I mean, Christianity has certainly been here before. I mean, if you look at the sort of philosophies of late antiquity, this idea of philosophy as a way of life. And Stoicism as a way of life, Epicureanism as a way of life, Pythagoreanism as a way of life. Philosophy was like religion in that sense. If you're a Pythagorean, you were a vegetarian, and that's because you had certain beliefs about the transmigration of souls, and it was both a religious, Pythagoras was both the leader of a religious cult and also a brilliant mathematician and plainly a philosopher. And they were, they were, as it were, therapeutic. We think, it's a Greek word, therapeia, the caring as a sort of care. And the caring of the psyche, the therapeia of the psyche, a sort of looking after of the soul. This was a classical pagan idea that Christianity was perfectly well aware of and defied, and it introduced a rival scheme that eventually won out, and which saw didn't see suffering as intrinsically wrong, as it always intrinsically negative. Understood that suffering could be virtuous, it could be a good. This is a profoundly countercultural, indeed scandalous thought to the pagan mind, that suffering could, as it were, be generative, could be freighted with meaning, that it wasn't the end of the world, as it were. But we have got to that point where, so we're beyond Nietzsche. This Nietzsche's whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Whatever doesn't kill you makes you weaker is the idea now. Anything we must make sure that we are as protected as possible. But we know that actually exposure to risk and danger is a recipe for psychological resilience. There's the famous study of the kids here in London during the Blitz. The contrasting studies over time on a whole wide range of outcomes of the kids who grew up in the Blitz and the kids who were in London during the Blitz and the kids who were evacuated to Scotland. And on every single outcome, every single measure, the Blitz kids were more resilient psychologically than the kids who've been evacuated.
That's interesting. I once had a very dear friend of mine. I was complaining bitterly about being attacked in the media by someone back in Australia, and I said I felt like I was suffering, and this good friend said to me, if you weren't suffering, John, I want to tell you, you'd be insufferable, because it's keeping you from getting bloated ideas about yourself. And
yes,
there's a bit of truth in that.
There is.
There really is. But as you say, we live in an age that doesn't believe suffering is part of the human experience. We're about the first age that ever has. Things have been so comfortable. Mm. We have so much. Mm. And yet it's not working. Can I just drill in? You touched on this idea of do no harm. So I guess that's a bit of a progression, isn't it? You had the covenantal agreement once that you know, as part of your faith, you would love your neighbour as yourself, and you'd do unto them as you wanted done unto them, and that sort of morphed into keep out of their way, don't visit any harm on anybody. In fact, it's very hard. If you're living for yourself, very hard not to inflict harm on others. Mm. And as we've seen now, we live in a culture where everybody's saying, someone has inflicted harm on me. Mm. That's at the heart of a therapeutic culture, it seems to me. Mm. And so in a sense, exercising those freedoms that we've had in the West to live as we like works only while ever it's conducted in a framework of responsibility and genuine commitment to others. Once it becomes selfish or disrespectful of others, freedom can, in fact, in itself become the very enemy of freedom.
Yes. This is the great paradox.
Yeah.
This is the great paradox that conservatives understand, but the liberals can't cope with. There are plenty of other things that conservatives don't understand or can't cope with. But this is the great paradox that total freedom leads to unfreedom. That if freedom is the thing you most value or most prioritize, then it's the last thing you'll actually get.
Actually, personally and in terms of the structures of society?
At both levels.
At
so
both
let's
levels?
Start with a personal. Just think of a relationship. Think of the meaning that one's life is invested with through a strong lifelong friendship. Mm. A lifelong friendship brings with it constraints on the sorts of things we will do and say with respect to that person. We don't even think of them as constraints because they are just trivially instrumental constraints on our freedom given the riches that flow from the friendship. Or consider at an even more basic level, just driving through London. I mean, it's not actually that easy to drive around London.
You're still allowed to do it, are you?
At the moment, I think our dear leader has put so many restrictions on what you can and can't do, what you can and can't drive, that it's very, very, very difficult. But, I mean, there is basically free-flowing traffic, and free-flowing traffic depends upon there being an incredibly elaborate system of rules and conventions and limits and constraints. It's those precise limits that liberate the traffic. And this idea that limits liberate is, it may seem paradoxical, but it's the most obvious thing in the world when you think about it. Liberalism can't cope with that, can't cope with limits. It's always chafing against limits. It can't deal with any limits at all, because any limit seems to be, or can be construed as, and correctly as, a constraint on my freedom.
Yeah. But you're not free once you turn it into license.
No, absolutely. When we're literally born tied to, by a biological cord, to our mums. I mean, we're born with this physical cord, limit. We're born into a dense web of unchosen obligations. And yes, maybe it's possible to cut free of those unchosen obligations over time. But you're not going to be able to live a fulfilling life if you don't pick up certain other obligations that you will agree to abide by. And so this is, part of the difficulty of a political philosophy that motivates and encourages individual freedom above all else is that it becomes pretty obvious in how we're moving from the private to the public. It becomes pretty obvious that the only possible policeman and guardian for the exercise of my individual freedoms against my fellow citizens is the state. If it's a non-state actor, then it is an affront on my individual freedom. It's some other group of individuals doing it. We all have to start turning towards a single leviathan, as it were, that is going to protect my freedoms. But once we get to that point, then we're lurching towards the very tyranny that liberalism set out trying to avert. Because the omnicompetent state is as the sole guarantor left of my individual freedoms once I've cut myself adrift from all the unchosen obligations that I might have that I previously had to nation, to neighborhood, to family, to friends, to guilds, and so on and so forth. I still need something to secure my freedom, to enforce my contractual rights and to protect my property rights and so on and so forth. And so one becomes dependent, more and more dependent on the state, and that becomes the primary relationship. And Burke's platoons disappear, civil society disappears, and then all of those intermediary institutions that make up the fabric of certainly this country, and I think, as Tocqueville saw in America, makes up the sort of what's so distinctive about American culture. All of that starts to fall away.
I think it might have been Charles Colson who said it's either the conscience or the constable. You know, the extent to which we exercise sensible restraint and our freedoms wisely, we won't need the constable. To the extent that we don't, and you see it everywhere because, you know, I know as a former legislator, but it's only built up an incredible head of steam since then. The whole idea now that my freedoms are being impinged upon, I'm not being treated rightly, has to be addressed by more and more and more and more endless red tape and government intervention. Mm.
The Colombian philosopher Nicolas Gomez de Vila once said that dying societies accumulate laws like dying men accumulate remedies. And it's often thought that a proliferation of regulation and laws and criminal and civil codes are evidence of a flourishing or sophisticated society. In fact, it's, I think, much more evidence of a society ill at ease with itself that has to compensate for the corrosion of public trust through the constable in the form of law. And I think we are certainly seeing more and more of that, and it's disquieting.
In the end, the building will topple over. I wonder whether our modern obsession with freedom of speech, which so often centres on someone feeling offended or whatever, perhaps because people use social media unwisely and they cancel others and then they think, well, this free speech thing's no good, isn't creating, in fact, a far deeper problem that's being obscured, which is that we're not having really robust conversations that little, you know, that can be completely depersonalised. They're about what sort of society we want to sort of have, what is the role of the individual versus the government, you know, what sort of economic models should we follow, what have you. The trivialisation, some of my listeners might think that's an unfair word to use, but around the issues of freedom of speech, are obscuring the greater problem. We're not having the great debates anymore. Mm-hmm.
I think that's true and false. I think it's true in the sense that the legacy institutions are struggling to avoid a kind of sclerosis and groupthink. And I think that's true also of the established institutions of Western society. I think it's false in the sense that you are now seeing the emergence of a sort of digital ecosystem that is opening up opportunities for long-form discussions of the kind we're having now, and you exemplify so well in your podcasts, of really thinking hard about these questions and disseminating these discussions on a scale that was previously unimaginable. So I think there's, you know, it's easy to get, one can be pessimistic, but I think one should be, there's cause for optimism too. In a way, in some ways, it's both, you know, the twilight of free speech and also sort of golden age of free speech as well. You know, I myself, you know, I've been in the trenches on certainly academic freedom and freedom of speech issues, but I've not had, I mean, I can't think of one occasion when I've had really my university tell me I can't say something, or you know, threaten me with consequences if having said something. There are sometimes, you know, processes and loom and so on. But I've generally found it okay. But it's true that within within sort of mainstream society there is this sense of walking on eggshells, of course. And I think the problem with groupthink,
I've said this before, that the trouble with groupthink is that wrongthink becomes evilthink. That a sufficiently, once a minority, intellectual minority gets sufficiently small on a particular view, it becomes very easy and obvious to demonize it. It's not just simply error, it's all dissent, it's evil, it's malevolent. Especially if the groupthink is allied to what everyone knows to be the case, or the evidence, or whatever it might be. And that's something we need to, and I think there's a sort of certain tipping point effect. So it could be that a public square where you've got a 70-30 split on a contentious issue is a healthy public square. I mean, even though there is, it's a bit out of kilter. And then there's a sort of, maybe the difference between 75 and 25 on the issue is a difference between the 30% being able to speak out and 25% suddenly being completely silent.
This is very interesting, isn't it? I mean, I would think the sweep of history's taught us, and I've certainly seen over my own lifetime, that very frequently the people who have the minority view, they may be very few in numbers, might be almost disregarded and written off as a nutcase's perspective, in fact, have turned out to be right, but their arguments aren't heard because they're so easily dismissed.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I think that's a true dynamic, certainly in the natural sciences. And you think of the great geniuses that the West has produced. They always typically started as a lone voice of one. It's funny, in the modern age we're kind of torn between a tyranny of the minority and a tyranny of the majority.
Yeah.
And we're sometimes, it's the wisdom of crowds, sometimes it's the madness of crowds. Mm. And crowds can be both very wise and very mad. And it's not always clear how those work. But yes, the basic principle that we should test received wisdom, however established it and consolidated it might seem, because received wisdom, to the extent that it's not just mathematical proofs, is always open to being tested. It's always possible that it might be wrong. Trying to sort of close that down is a recipe for social sclerosis. And Mill puts this very well. These are the classic arguments for freedom of speech from the liberal perspective in chapter 2 of On Liberty, 1859. You might be wrong. Argument number one: you might be wrong. Perfectly possible. You're not going to know if you're wrong if you haven't exposed your views to, if you don't allow others freely to criticize you. Argument number two, chances are you're partly right and partly wrong. That's where most of us are partly right and partly wrong about everything. You're not going to know which bits are right and which bits are wrong if you haven't, put it through the sorting mechanism, which requires there to be people who are freely and without fear going to criticize and sort through your arguments and tell you which bits are right and which bits are wrong. And the third argument, my favorite, he who knows only his own side knows little of that.
John Stuart Mill.
John Stuart Mill, chapter 2 on liberty. That is to say, it's a very subtle point. Even if you're completely right, you're not really going to know that you're right, or not really going to feel the force of your right views if they haven't been through the crucible of criticism, open, fair, free criticism, scrutiny. And all three of those arguments are I think powerful. They've come under criticism, and in fact, as a conservative, million liberalism has all kinds of problems for me. We've talked about the no harm principle, both psychologically applied and applied in the usual sense. But of course, Mills on Liberty is a sort of manifesto for experiments in living, motivating everyone to test the conventions and always to test the sort of received structures and established patterns of family, faith, flag, which I'm not particularly on board with. I mean, I want to live in a society in which people who want to conduct experiments in living are free to do so. But I don't like living in. I'm not keen on a society where those people are, as it were, lionized in those experiments and living are seen to be what all must do on leaving, you know, on attaining freedom and on leaving university or whatever. Those the sort of, you know, the 60s approach, I think, is not wise. But Mill has a lot to say about, you know, to our modern problems, certainly within cancel culture and over freedom of speech, as do many others. But these are the debates are happening. Certainly in Britain, I feel, in the university context and actually more broadly in the public square, there are, if not in the legacy media institutions, there are now disruptive agents in the media landscape, in the institutional landscape. Perhaps not so much in the party political landscape, sadly, but of non-conform expressions of profoundly non-conformist opinion. I think this is especially true of the debate between trans supporters of trans ideology and the gender critical feminists. You know, I think that the British gender critical feminists have modelled how respectful civil disagreement that presupposes freedom of speech and freedom of conscience and academic freedom, it can be done and can actually lead to a healthy public square. And I think that the same is true probably of debates over race too. I think generally speaking, provided we're not trying to import sort of neuralgia over race from the United States and transpose it into the UK context, I think generally speaking, you know, apart from maybe in 2020, where we were doing just that importing, I think generally speaking, we have had better debates over race and heritage and history. Of course, there have been flashpoints, but generally speaking, it's been, I think, you know, often very difficult, but generally informed and fair and clarifying. Whether that will continue to be the case is not at all clear, but I feel that the public square is in a better state of health relative to the United States, certainly, and that where things are going wrong, it can generally be attributed to us us importing problems from the United States. And I've said this before somewhere that it's great. I've been a Brexiteer since I was 13. I grew up in Brussels. I know wherever I speak. Wonderful that we have reclaimed our political sovereignty from Brussels, but there's no point in regaining our political sovereignty from Brussels if we're going to surrender our cultural sovereignty to Washington, New York, Harvard, and Silicon Valley. And there's no point in becoming a free and sovereign nation again with respect to the European Union if we're just going to be a sort of colonial satrapy of the global American empire.
Amen to that. I think that Britain has played an incredibly positive role, net terms, if you like, building a civilized approach to living with one another. And it'd be a great shame to see it not return to a leadership role in that regard. But one of the flashpoints that you used that term a moment ago that I think is really deeply concerning to any thoughtful observer, centres on the outrageous attack by Hamas on Israel and the rapid emergence that there are many in the West who loathe Israel and who are prepared to turn, at the very least, a surprisingly blind eye to what Hamas did and the evil that it represented. And you made a very interesting comment, as I understand it. You tweeted at one stage, import the Arab world, become the Arab world. I'd be very interested to know what you meant by that, if you could just fill us in.
I was asked by a colleague to clarify this tweet the other day, and I refused to clarify it because I said to clarify it would be to assume that it was in need of clarification. There were some bad faith misreadings of it that created quite a fuss. So, I mean, it was simple, really. If you if you bring in, if there are large numbers of unchecked immigration at scale without any clear accompanying policy or culture of assimilation, which is the case if you have a doctrinaire commitment within government to multiculturalism, you are simply going to replicate the ethnic, religious, tribal tensions of the people you bring in. When you cross, you cross through passport control at Heathrow, you're here as an economic migrant for the first time. All the views that you grew up with don't suddenly disappear and transmute themselves magically into the values that we associate with Britain over the centuries. And so, let's do a thought experiment on this. I mean, imagine that Nigeria had imported 2 million Irishmen picked at random in the 1960s. If they had imported the Irish world, they would have become the Irish world. If they had also said, there's your Irish ghetto, you do your Irish thing, don't worry about Nigeria, we're just going to sort of keep an eye on you, do your Irish stuff, Irish pubs, we love Ireland, 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 Ireland. You would have replicated the troubles in Belfast, in Lagos. And so that's what I meant by the comment. That's why we shouldn't have been surprised to see within hours of the terrorist attacks on October the 7th, with the blood of the victims was still warm before Israel had done anything, had responded in any way at all. We saw on the streets outside the Israeli embassy in London, fireworks being fired, Israelis, Jews, terrified of simply going to pay their respects at the embassy. We saw Turkish flags. We saw Muslims praying. What were they praying about? Were they praying for the safety and the safe return of the hostages? Who knows? Who knows?
We don't have
the windows into men's souls.
No.
But the flying of a Palestinian flag within hours of an attack as horrific as that, the most horrific attack on Jews since the Holocaust, was plainly a celebration of terrorism, not a protest against Israeli policy towards Palestine, just in terms of the timing. And that seems to me obvious. Once 2 or 3 weeks have elapsed and there's a sort of strong Israeli response, then sure, I can see that flying a Palestinian flag starts to revert to the sort of status quo ante. But that was the image or the video, I think, that my statement sort of went with, and I still stand by. And not only did I think it was true at the time, I think it's become truer and more accurate with every hour that passes in every major city across the Western world. We have seen these tensions being replicated. And just look at the numbers. I mean, we have, the percentage of Brits who do not think that Hamas is a terrorist organization is about 6%. The percentage of Londoners who think that Hamas is not a terrorist organization is 15%. That is to say, in a city of roughly 10 million, 1.5 million people think that what Hamas did on October the 7th to pregnant mothers, to babies, to children, to Holocaust survivors, was not terror. 1.5 million. Now, where does that anti-Semitism come from? George Orwell has a famous essay on this, anti-Semitism in England, I think. He does record that the English are not free of anti-Semitism. We've had it, shamefully. We had it. We expelled the Jews for 400 years from the 13th century to the 17th century, and Cromwell brought them back. We're not completely free of it, but we have not for centuries seen the levels of open anti-Semitic abuse on the streets of our capital and all over the country, but particularly in our capital, that we've seen in recent weeks. And it's shameful. We should be ashamed of it. This is why I was so proud to sign the October Declaration, which Laura Dodsworth and Toby Young and others put together a few days ago, in response to this a shocking letter by 4,000 celebrities that cited the plight of the population of Gaza being used as political military pawns by Hamas, though they didn't point that out, but were completely silent on the terrorist atrocities of October the 7th. I mean, this was extraordinary, and so there has been a response to that. And that letter, I think it's gathered nearly 30,000-40,000 signatures. So I stand by the comment. There was a tantrum about it in the student newspapers, but that's a fairly routine occurrence for me. If you're one of the very few out-of-the-closet conservatives at Cambridge, and it's been a slow news week, then that's what you do. You don't go investigating, you don't go looking for stories. You just open up Twitter and look down. You'll look down Dr. Orr's Twitter account and find something. And this is what happened. I mean, these outrages are so confected. It'll be a bored editor or a disgruntled colleague or student will look for something, send it in, or send it to the affected the society. And in this case, I think it was the Muslim or Arab or Palestinian student society. And read this tweet? Are you offended by it? Are you hurt by it? Yes, of course we are. Right, and then the story starts to come together. And then it's published, and then you sort of try to get some action online, and then you sort of write to Dr. Orr's faculty. Does the university know about this? How could students possibly attend lectures when he's saying things like this? And it just gets confected. This is a sort of what my friend Doug Stokes calls the grievance industrial complex. Sort of whipped up, and then then the Mail will get hold of it, or someone will, some tabloid will get hold of it, and then the anti-woke brigade get on board. And so you have this sort of woke, anti-woke dynamic, and it just gets so boring. And I try to ignore it as much as I can, and the university, to its great credit, lets me ignore it. I haven't had any trouble at all. A few conversations here and there, but those conversations have always ended with the reassurance that the University of Cambridge respects the freedom of its academics to say whatever they want within the law, even if what they say may cause controversy. I'm not sure that's the case in Harvard or Princeton, or I don't know if it is the case in Australian universities, but I feel free in a place like Cambridge to say what I want. I mean, I know that there are likely to be tantrums, but if you're used to them and you know how the game works, it's hard to get terribly bothered by them. There was an amazing lecture earlier in the week by the great Peter Thiel in Oxford, and one of Peter's brilliant points is that this whole woke, anti-woke dynamic is, well, it's partly a ressentiment in the Nietzschean sense. It's this sort of sense of, I'm disempowered and impoverished. How can I kind of get up in the world? Well, I can, if I'm in a very competitive workplace and I can, there's 10 people fighting for one promotion, and I can get rid of three of them through doing some grievance archaeology on Twitter. I mean, of course I'm going to do it. I'm going to love cancel culture. That's a kind of subtle point. So there's ressentiment, but Peter's point is there's divertissement as well. Diversity is a diversion strategy. It's very subtle. The opportunity cost of constantly having to go at the pace of the slowest kid in the class, or the most psychologically fragile kid in the class. Even if you win, against the woke, you've lost so much time, lost so much energy. I mean, it's just so demeaning, isn't it? I think what satisfaction can one get from winning arguments in the public square that no, men are actually men, and women are actually women, and men can't become women, and women can't become men? I mean, what sort of intellectual satisfaction are you going to get from that? You've got victory, but at what price?
You've been very generous with your time. I admire your mind, I admire your good humour and your graciousness. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, John.
Thank you for listening to Conversations with John Anderson. For further content, visit johnanderson.net.au. If you enjoy this podcast, please leave a rating and a review in iTunes. It helps other listeners find us. Thank you.
Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.